to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito with you here on the radio waves with Mary Lou Nemecek, and we are going to, this is kind of a long wind up into introducing ourselves for Lent, into introducing the Lenten season, which this year begins a little bit sooner than I was expecting. And but first, I wanted to kind of discuss this article that you showed me, Mary Lou, which I thought was really good. It's taken from C.S. Lewis's little booklet called The Weight of Glory. And if you've never, okay, C.S. Lewis, Clive Stapleton Lewis obviously was a scholar and a writer who died in 1963. As a matter of fact, he died the same day
that Kennedy was, yeah. Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, he got no press at all. But he is has got to be. He and J.R. Tolkien have got to. Well, and Peter Kreft. Well, okay. There's a whole pantheon of my favorite writers, but C.S. Lewis. For some reason, I seem to go back consistently to him just for images. The images that he gives of the facts of the Christian life are just peerless. They're just so effective. And here he's addressing, I actually have a friend of mine, a guy who lives in Canada, who's always asking these questions. He's always, and I'm going to send him this article because I thought it would be very helpful. He's always asking, like, should we really be spending this money for a cup of coffee when we could be sending it to, you know, Uganda or something? And should we really be going to the movies? And should we really be getting our children nice things? And he's kind of stuck on the horns of this dilemma, you know, about the poor and all that stuff. And I thought that C.S. Lewis's answer that he gives in The Weight of Glory, which is a little sort of is extracted in a series of talks that he gave at Oxford, where he taught.
And wasn't he doing these talks during the war?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, which I thought was interesting because well, we can just plunge into it. You can find it on aletheia.org. C.S. Lewis tells you what to do with your life if you want to Google it. I thought it was very short, but very nice. And it's extracted by David Mills on January the 24th, 2018. I thought this was kind of fun because he answers these questions with such aplomb and common sense and yet mm-hmm. holiness, you know? All of it all mixed into one, which is always unusual, right? So here in 1939, so they're gathered in 1939 at the Anglican Church of St. Mary the Virgin in Oxford. And he said that he kind of shocked his audience by using the word hell. He had just used the word hell. He used it to explain to the people gathered that evening in autumn 1939 at what they should do with their lives. So, not that their lives should be hell, but that the playing out of our lives needs to be an avoidance of eternal separation, which is what we call by the Teutonic root of hell, right?
Right.
See, there's no such word in that the word in the Latin and in Greek does not sound the same. In Latin, it's infernus, but this Anglo-Saxon word kind of describes the reality of Gehenna, you know, of eternal separation. And Jesus himself spoke about hell, which is eternal separation from God, many times in the Gospels. Matter of fact, it may be one of the subjects he discusses the most, which I thought was kind of shocking. You know, so, mm-hmm. So I guess it's an avoidance, but it should be a lot more than that. You know, just you know, flying straight and straightening up and doing what you're supposed to do shouldn't just be something we do because we fear the ultimate consequence. It should be something that we do because we love the Lord. All right, so you would think that the people gathered in the university right there, so which I thought was kind of funny, that they would take turns, the professors would take turns giving sermons in the church, which is certainly
unheard of here.
From our reality here, right, in
right.
2018 in the West. But back then, there was this very, very interesting sort of mixing, blurring of the lines. And I do recommend The Weight of Glory. I have quoted more stuff out of The Weight of Glory and also Mere Christianity, well, and also The Chronicles of Narnia and also the Space Trilogy. I seem to have
you
a
love
lot
them
of
all.
Material from C.S. Lewis. But he basically, this is the scene. Germany had been gobbling up most of Europe. In 1939, it had invaded Belgium, the Blitzkrieg. It was in Austria. I mean, things were just coming to a head, and it was looking bad. And England had just declared war on Germany. And it says in the article, Germany wasn't just a hostile power. It was a wicked power.
Mm-hmm.
How wicked, the English didn't yet know. Europe faced the possible end of its civilization. So, you know, just to put it all in context, the Second World War, with the wickedness of Germany and Japan, you know, the axis of evil, was the backdrop that served C.S. Lewis and also J.R. Tolkien to illustrate evil. Like, they had examples right in front of them. And that is kind of what they pointed to show what evil looks like when an evil power does what Germany did, which was basically try and take over the world and kill the people who were not worthy or something along those lines, right?
And it carries on to this day, because when we talk about someone who's evil, we think of Hitler automatically, because that's something that really was a turning point in the world. And it was, I recently saw that movie Churchill, and it was really very, very good. And the Germans had invaded France. And, you know, they were trying to get the troops out of Dunkirk. And, you know, if you've been to England and France, you know that that channel is not very wide. I mean, they were on their doorstep, and they weren't prepared for it. And it was such a turning point, because England had to decide. There were people in England that wanted to just
appease,
try to make peace with Hitler. And Churchill was the one that convinced them to fight. And we know the result of that. So you can see this, when you think about this C.S. Lewis and these talks and what the people were going through, I mean, it was a life and death situation for them each and every day.
Which is why I think this little sermonette, this little booklet really had a big impact on them.
Absolutely.
Right. So they're confronted with this wicked power. And why? And then so Lewis kind of underlines sort of the seeming futility of them teaching Greek literature at a time like this. Right. Why sit in comfort with your books when you and your friend may go to war at any moment and maybe die? Why should anyone keep studying when the world's in crisis? Why should anyone be in comfort and study when your country itself might die, which was a very real possibility?
Exactly.
How can you justify studying ancient Greek grammar when you could be working on the assembly making fighter planes or tanks? How can we indulge such pleasures when men and women we know might go to hell? So that's an interesting question, because we all fight with that balance, don't we?
We do.
You know, as a young person anyway, I always had we all had our St. Francis moment, at least I did, you know, like, oh, just renounce the world and live in holiness and don't have anything and give all your money away and all that stuff. Well, you know, it didn't last very long for me, but you do have, there's that impulse to kind of say, hey, people are dying on the vine. I should be in a full-time ministry and I should give all my stuff away and I should just like sort of live, you know, on the edge like the Lord did. But I thought what was really interesting was C.S. Lewis saying, well, you know, the important thing is we need to do what we do in normal life for God, for the sake of the Lord. And that does not mean that we have to live somebody else's life. So, you know, unless we're called to the life of a Franciscan or a consecrated religious or a member of the clergy or sort of a missionary who goes out there to foreign countries, there's probably not a whole lot call for us to live their life if we haven't been called to it. I guess that's what it boils down to. What have we been called to do? You know, most of us are called a marriage. Most of us are called a family life. Most of us are called to live in the world.
That's exactly right.
It's what one of the Vatican Council's documents, a decree on the laity, points out. It says the clergy is supposed to come alongside the laity and give them the sacraments and the comforts of the faith and teaching and all that stuff. But it's really up to the laity to go out and evangelize. You know, I think it's section 4 says the laity is to evangelize, sanctify, penetrate, and perfect the temporal order. What's a temporal order? It's everyday life, you know. So because there's been this kind of tendency since Vatican II whereby the only way I'm going to be religious is if I darken the doors of the church 24/7. So if I'm a sacristan and a lector and a Eucharistic minister, and if I, every time there's something there, I rearrange the chairs. Well, yeah, some people are called to do that. But for the most part, that's not what we as laity are called to do. We're called to live the lives that God has called us to do in an excellent fashion. And that is how we evangelize. And I think that's kind of where he's coming from. He's also kind of picking up the same line of discussion that Saint José María Escrivá, the famous, the founder of Opus Dei in the 20s in Spain, had. That idea that you can be a saint and you can be excellent by even if you're living in the world, which was at the time a very interesting concept, not a very well-known concept for most Catholics, right? Most Catholics, laity, you tell me, would grow up thinking they need to pay, pray, and obey, right?
That's right.
So this idea of mission is something that's a bit, you know, out of a lot of people's comfort zone, right? But the idea is that our normal lives are going to be the source of mission. And I think that's what he is addressing. He asks his comfortable academic peers a very good question, and we have to answer it too. So they had to answer it in 1939 in Oxford in a comfortable academic circle. One would even say the academic ivory tower, right? But we too, every Catholic, every Christian, must answer the same question. Most of us live in some comfort, able to do much of what we want to do, but the world around us lives in great need. And especially that should apply for those of us living in the United States, America, with the third millennium, with every comfort. I mean, even the poorest of the poor here have running water and electricity, and they may have a flat screen TV, and they may have a cell phone, and they may, along with their food stamps, you know? So even the people that we deem the poor are richer than any king ever dreamed of being up until about 300 years ago. And that's huge. I think that's really huge. We are so affluent. We are so wealthy. How can we justify living in this comfort when people are dying in huts in the third world? That's an interesting question. So what do we do about that? Why keep here? Interesting series of questions. Why keep reading that book on a saint when people start and they visit them? How can you host that cookout when the soup kitchen downtown needs volunteers? Do you really need to go to that church conference when the money that you spend would feed an African village for a week? Should we enjoy a movie when we could be telling people about Jesus? So there's that whole idea about balance, which I thought was interesting. Think of Jesus' words. Now, these are the words, obviously, of the guy who wrote the article, not so much of C.S. Lewis. He's kind of using C.S. Lewis's Weight of Glory as a jumping off point, David Mills. What you did for the least of these, you did for me. What you didn't do for the least of these, therefore, you did not do for me. So look at the lives of the saints who spent themselves in unending service to others. When Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die, said Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who ended up hung by Hitler in the closing days of the war because he was a Lutheran pastor and he was speaking the truth. So when you compare ourselves, at least when I don't know about you, Mary Lou, but when I compare myself to somebody like Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Catherine of Siena or, you know, Teresa of Avila or, you know, the saints that lived 40 years just on the Eucharist alone without eating.
Exactly.
The saints who slept on the floor with a rock for a pillow, and the saints like St. Francis, who were basically bums, right, who went around mm-hmm. begging begging and dressed in garbage bags, which is what burlap was at the time. It was for garbage before plastic. So there is a way in which you can say, now, wait a minute, what do we do about that? Have you ever had those thoughts?
Absolutely.
It's interesting.
And,
it
reminds me so of the nuns when we would be having lunch in the lunchroom, and they would come around and say, finish your food, because there are children starving in Africa. You know, it was, we looked on it as our kind of a Catholic guilt thing. And so we would sit there and say, even if we finish our food, it doesn't make any difference as to what's going to happen to those children in Africa.
Right.
But it did give us that sense of that guilt that they wanted to instill in us to appreciate what you just said of what we have versus what others have. And what are we going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How does Lewis answer his own question? He doesn't answer directly, but he says, you must serve God with all your heart and soul and mind, but part of serving God as a human being is living a normal human life. Isn't that beautiful? A normal human life. Not everybody's called to be Padre Pio. You know, not everybody's called to be Mother Teresa. Not everybody's called to be, you know.
And I'm thankful I wasn't called to be Mother Teresa.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Right.
You must take up your cross and follow Jesus. But you take up the cross in and through that life, not Mother Teresa's life, your life, my life. And that's where I think discernment comes in, especially early on. What are we called to? Are we called to marriage? Are we called to consecrated life? Are we called to mission? Are we called to mission in the everyday life of the laity? You know, what kind of life are we called to? And then once we discern that call, we should inhabit it fully and not be apologetic. You know, that we're not in some cell somewhere, you know, some hermit's cell, because that's not what God has called us to do. So really, it's better, I think, to answer God, to answer the call God puts on our lives, and to live the lives that he has called us to do. And I would submit to you that sometimes it's almost harder, I think, to live a life of radical discipleship smack in the middle of the world, right?
I totally agree with that. Because, you know, we're here trying to evangelize our own families and those close to us, which is the hardest thing to do. To go out and evangelize to strangers is far easier. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're called to do. We're called to start with our own family, where we are and what our vocation is. And, you know, Mother Teresa would always see the face of Jesus in all those people that she took care of in the hospitals and so forth. And I would submit to you that it to me, it's a bit easier to see the face of Jesus in those that are suffering like that. It's harder to see the face of Jesus in those close by around us within our family. It's a real challenge at times.
Those who push our buttons.
Exactly. So when you say you must follow Jesus and take up that cross in and through that life, this life that we lead now is what we're called to do. We are called to kind of bloom where we're planted, so to speak.
Absolutely. And he advises three things. One, keep doing what you've been called to do, remembering that you're part of a body. So that's a great consolation, because there is room in the body for somebody who's going to live on the Eucharist for 40 years and somebody like Padre Pio. But there's also room for me, and there's room for you, and there's room for everybody in the middle, right? I mean, there's...
Exactly.
It's a body. We are differentiated members, each with his own vocation. We serve God best through our vocation, not by taking up someone else's. That is so freeing, isn't it?
It is, and I think sometimes we spend too much time trying to take up someone else's.
Right, exactly.
We miss the boat.
Exactly. By doing what we're supposed to do, we are either advancing the vision of God ourselves or indirectly helping others to do so, which sometimes can be kind of irksome, because we want to be the one advancing God. You know, we want to be in the middle. We don't want to just be assists. Right?
Exactly.
We don't want to just be setting up the lob. We want to smash the overhead, to use tennis language. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that's what we're called to do. Sometimes the holiest thing we can do is set up the lob and just depart and not look any further. Or, you know, do the things that God has called us to do, and indirectly also perhaps help others to do so.
You know, Solanus Casey comes to mind. Mm-hmm. There was a person that no one, I believe, in the beginning thought that he would amount to
right.
such a great saint as he is. And there he was, a humble man, you know, the porter, the doorman that people saw first, and he was the one that they chose to speak to, and he used that ministry of meeting those people right at the entrance, right at the door. Mm-hmm. And I think he's a powerful example of, you know, just doing through his vocation, his humble vocation, of what God wanted him to do. And by doing so, think of all those people that absolutely were healed, were their faith was made came to life, that mm-hmm. they practiced their faith, that their lives were changed by that intervention by him, by that meeting him. And here he was, someone that most people didn't even know this was going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That there's that idea of not taking someone else's vocation up, but doing your own thing. By doing what we're supposed to do, we are either advancing to the vision of God ourselves, or indirectly helping others to do so. Such a beautiful phrase. How God uses our work, we probably cannot see, right?
Right.
In this way, it's up to him. Meaning what? God does not owe us a progress report, right? Mother Teresa used to say, God calls us to be faithful, not successful.
Exactly.
Because we tend to want to measure success by worldly indices, and that's not what we're supposed to do. Second thing, if we're going to do it anyway, we should might as well do it well, which applies to obviously all the things in our lay life. He says, if you're going to read, make sure you read good books, because if you're still going to read, but if you're going to read and you don't read good books, you'll end up reading bad ones. And if you're going to have to think, but you might as well think rationally, because if not, you will think irrationally. And if you reject higher aesthetic satisfactions, you will fall into sensual satisfactions, which means what? We are geared towards reading, thinking, and receiving satisfaction. Let's make sure to make it count. Right?
Exactly.
And good philosophy, that's one thing I talked about yesterday in the lecture at a Catholic Way Bible Study for 1 Corinthians. The Corinthians were up against all kinds of weird theology and heresy and philosophies. And our modern world tends to say something like, well, it doesn't really matter, all that thought stuff, you know, it just matters what you do. But, you know, what you do depends on what you know, and what you know depends on the philosophies that you're exposed to. So in the end, you're always espousing one thought, one philosophy, one theology, or another. So philosophy matters. Good ideas matter. Good doctrine matter. The Corinthians, there were some there who were rejecting the resurrection and saying, what does it matter, you know, if we're raised from the dead? And Paul goes to great trouble to explain that if you don't believe in the resurrection, you will fall into materialism. You know, you will fall. There has dire ideas have consequences. So a good philosophy must exist, is for no other reason because bad philosophy needs to be answered. That's C.S. Lewis, very practical. The Germans may be bombing you, but someone will be preaching poisonous nonsense and hurting human souls. Someone needs to know what to say in response. That someone needs to be studying when others are on the assembly line making fighter planes or tanks, which I thought was beautiful, right?
Let me share a story with you. I just saw this movie. I think it was, forget the name of it, Alone in Berlin or something like that. Anyway, a German couple in Berlin, their son was just lost in the war, and they really didn't believe in the war. And after they lost their son, they felt like they needed to do something. So the husband, Otto, would take little cards and write on those lines that to urge people to start thinking about what Hitler was doing, and he would point out different things that was going on at that point in time, and he would go around the city and drop these cards off on staircases and different places, and they would be picked up, and of course the Germans, the SS, wanted to find out who was doing this. So it went on for a long time, and he went into his place of work, and he had a card in his pocket. He had a hole in his pocket. It fell out. It was discovered.
Oh.
he told the manager to go ahead and they must report that, so on and so forth. And make a long story short, he was captured, and he and his wife, they were somewhat tortured. And they were ultimately killed. They were guillotined, actually. But it was that he sent out 185 cards, and there were 18 of them that the police did not pick up, that others. And the policeman that was going after them recognized that what they were doing was actually right. So he took all the cards he had gathered, threw them out the window so that the people on the street could pick them up, and he ultimately committed suicide.
Oh, great.
Yes. But the point is that those people under those circumstances found something that they could do mm-hmm. to send out the truth, to go against that philosophy of Hitler.
Right.
And they were willing to suffer death to do that, which they did.
That's
but
right.
But I had never heard that. This is based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
This was not a made up situation. And I just thought it was just such a beautiful story of someone, you know, from my perspective, doing God's work because they were trying to put out the truth against him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In a small way that made a big difference.
And when someone is preaching poisonous nonsense and hurting human souls, you do what you step up to the plate, right?
Exactly.
The third thing that he suggests is that God created and honors normal human life as long as we do what we do for him. So it's okay to throw a dinner party as long as you do it in the name of the Lord. It's okay to have a barbecue as long as you do it in the name of the Lord. It's okay, you know. It's even Christians may go to dinner parties, which I thought was interesting, right? Whatever we eat or drink or do, we do it to the glory of God. Christianity does not simply replace our natural life and substitute a new one. It inhabits our regular life,
mm-hmm.
right? And makes it a new life. That's another one of the points that Paul makes to the church of Corinth. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean that all the circumstances of your old life are gone. No, you still inhabit your old life. If you're a slave, you remain a slave.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a servant, you remain a servant. If you're a soldier, you remain a soldier, right? If you're a wife or a husband, you remain in that position. Don't use Christianity as an excuse to kind of ditch, you know, something that you may not be satisfied with. So the new organization of our life exploits to its own supernatural ends the natural materials of our lives. So C.S. Lewis isn't saying just brighten the corner where you are. He's saying do more in the name of God, but do make sure that you do brighten that corner, right?
Right.
And he gives a great example. A cookout, for example, can be held through the glory of God. You bring people together in fellowship. Make it a bigger fellowship. I am always doing that. I may have 10 plates, but if I find somebody else I want to invite, I'll set an 11th plate that doesn't match. I have 10 hamburgers, and I invite two more people. I won't eat the hamburger, and I'll make my husband not eat his hamburger. You know what I'm saying? So that the people, I include them. I'm not restricted by, you know, I mean, I am restricted by the size of my house, okay? And I am restricted sometimes by how much food I have. But the idea is to make it a bigger fellowship.
I can attest to that because
right?
I was actually having something at my house and you kept inviting more people to come.
That's right.
That's right. And you said, I ran into so-and-so and I want them to come too.
And
I can attest to that.
The main point is invite them. Invite them into fellowship. Whenever there's Christians gathering together, there should be that warmth, that inclusion. I just don't see Jesus saying, I don't have enough plates.
Exactly.
I don't see the Blessed Mother saying, oh, I only have 10 hamburgers, you know. I just don't see that, you know, and I think that's kind of the points that C.S. Lewis is making. So live your life according to the call that God has put on your life. Don't expect to live, to inhabit a different life, but what you do, do it for the glory of God. And that is how we will evangelize the culture and spread the kingdom of God. Thank you for joining us.